The question that will decide our destiny is not whether we shall expand into space. It is, shall we be one species or a million? A million species will not exhaust the ecological niches that are awaiting the arrival of intelligence. You are listening to Western Worlds. Another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, located in the 10th largest city in the country, London, Ontario, Canada. Are we alone in the universe? It's a question that has intrigued humankind ever since we realized that those points in the night sky were other planets and other suns with worlds of their own. For much of history, we could only wonder, but with the invention of the radio telescope, we gained a way to investigate this question in a scientific manner. That rigorous approach is why the Drake Equation defines an intelligent civilization as a people who are capable of building radio telescopes and led to the formation of a group known as the SETI Institute. SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They are most well known for using time on large radio telescopes to try and detect signals from other stars. These need not be transmissions explicitly sent to us. After all, our civilization has been a noisy one in an electromagnetic sense. The radio frequency leakage of our television, radio, and other broadcasts over the past century is detectable across an ever-expanding bubble of space centered on the solar system, and the same may be true of other civilizations. You can even help out the SETI Institute by downloading a program that will help them sift through their observations using the idle time on your own home computer. In many ways, such interplanetary transmissions are the most realistic form of first contact, as suggested by Arthur C. Clarke. Perhaps someday we will get the chance to truly know what awaits us out there, as Freeman Dyson hopes in our opening quote. But SETI does much more than search the heavens for stray messages. They also fund and carry out a wide variety of astronomical and planetary research aimed at understanding habitability of our own solar system and beyond, and the conditions that led to the rise of life on our own planet. To talk about their activities, tonight our interview features Dr. Seth Shostak of the SETI Institute. He recently sat down with our own Parshdi Patel. Accompanying our interview tonight is Expression by Helen Jane Long.
Talking to us today. Let me just start off by asking you, how did this idea of finding aliens came to your mind? Because it's not usual. Even in terms of astronomy, you normally go to planetary science or, you know, galaxies and things like that. How did searching aliens came to your mind?
Well, I think I can trace this back to when I was a graduate student, and it was very late at night at the radio observatory somewhere behind the Sierra Nevada mountains in California. I was sitting there at 3 o'clock in the morning using these big antennas to study galaxies. And I happened to be reading a book that had just come out by a fellow by the name of Carl Sagan and Joseph Schlosky, in which they discussed the fact that these antennas could be used to also perhaps find evidence that there's intelligent life out there. And I have to say, at 3 a.m, that was a very romantic idea. So that's how it began with me.
What kind of science is exactly done at SETI?
Well, the SETI Institute, where I work, has, you know, on the order of 130 people working there. Now, very few of them are doing what I do, which is SETI, which is, you know, trying to find intelligent life elsewhere in the galaxy by eavesdropping on signals. Most of the scientists there are doing what's called astrobiology. So they're interested in life, but not necessarily intelligent life, life like you might find on Mars or some of the moons of the outer solar system, or just understanding how life got started on the Earth. How do you get life started, or how do you make the chemical requirements of life? All these are aspects of what is called astrobiology. So that's what the number one research area of the SETI Institute is, actually.
What kind of aliens are we actually looking for? Do you think we would be able to find human-like aliens? Or we are looking for, let's say, small virus or bacteria or things like that?
Well, I think that we're looking for all kinds of life, of course. It's very likely that there's a lot more single-celled, if you will, stupid life than there is intelligent life, right? I mean, think of the Earth. The Earth has had life for maybe 4 billion years. And up until recently, it was all single cell. Up until, you know, half a billion years ago, it was all single cell. So the majority of the history of life, even on this planet, has been life you need a microscope to see. So I suspect that most of the life in the universe is indeed microscopic. And we could find that. We could find that by just sending a spacecraft to some of the other worlds in our own solar system. You might even find it by looking at at planets around other star systems and measuring the light coming off those planets, and you might find evidence of oxygen or methane in the atmosphere, either one of which would be a good clue that there's some sort of life there. So, you know, finding this kind of very simple, well, it's not really simple, but, you know, small in any case, life, that might be something that we could do with our spacecraft or with telescopes. Finding intelligent life, well, intelligent life might produce radio signals. So that's how we look for them. There's sort of, in a way, three different methods for finding life in space.
Okay, would you like to describe a little bit more about how, in terms of observations, would one be able to actually look for such signals for life? Let's say, like, looking for radio signals. So how would an astronomer would actually do something like that? Maybe describe a little bit of the process.
Yeah, well, if you're looking for intelligent life and you're doing it by looking for radio signals, you need a big antenna. The bigger, the better. This is one more human endeavor where bigger really is better, because a bigger antenna will be able to find fainter signals. Now, there are a few things you don't know. You don't know where to point the antenna, right? Where is ET hanging out? I mean, we don't know that. But what we do is we point at stars where we know there are planets, or we think they might have planets. As it turns out, probably all stars have planets, or at least the majority of them do. So maybe it doesn't matter too much. But the other thing you don't know is, at what spot on the radio dial are they broadcasting? What frequency are they transmitting? And we don't know that. And ET never sent us a program guide telling us where to tune. So we try and tune over as many different frequencies as we can. We also don't know the nature of the signal. Is it, you know, a very narrow signal? Is it a wide signal? Is it pulsed? Is it not pulsed? So we have to, you know, do our best to just find anything that looks like it was made by a transmitter. And the last thing you don't know is how sensitive does your equipment have to be to pick up ET? After all, they're likely to be hundreds or thousands of light years away, so the signal will be weak. So, yeah, it's a bit of a shot in the dark, but we do the best we can, try to second guess what they're doing.
So would we expect anything in our solar neighborhood or even in the Milky Way galaxy? Can we expect life anywhere?
Well, I think that you can expect life. If life is very commonplace, you can expect it even nearby. Now, it's not going to be intelligent life. You're not going to find intelligent beings on Mars. Or some of the moons of Jupiter, even though, in, you know, three of the moons of Jupiter probably have more water, liquid water, than the Earth does, right? And there may be life there, but it's not going to be terribly clever. It's not going to hold up its side of the conversation, right? So you could find that by just, you know, spending enough on your space program. It's mostly a money question, really, to look for that kind of life. If you're talking about finding intelligent life, I mean, are we going to find it in our galaxy? Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, the galaxy has a couple of 100,000 million stars, right? And so, you know, it probably has on the order of a trillion, with a T, trillion planets. And if only one in a million of those have some sort of intelligent life, that's still a million worlds with life, just in our galaxy. And of course, there are many other galaxies. So yeah, I'm very optimistic that there's life in our galaxy, because if not, then we're really more special than even my mom thought I was.
So what is your thought about the Drake equation?
Yeah, well, Frank Drake came up with this equation in 1961. It was just an agenda for a meeting, actually, that was held in West Virginia, where he was bringing together people who were interested in this idea of trying to eavesdrop on signals. And he just tried to figure out, well, how many worlds out there are likely to be broadcasting signals? I mean, if that's really tiny, if the number in our galaxy is very small, then there's probably not much point in trying to find them. If it's large, then you have a chance. And so he just made this little equation to sort of calculate it. But the problem is that the calculation depends on things you don't know. I mean, it includes how many stars are out there and what fraction of those have planets. We sort of know what that is. But what you don't know is what fraction of planets, even those that are good planets, actually cook up life, and what fraction of those ever cook up technologically sophisticated life. Those are things we know nothing about. And the last term in the Drake equation, which we really don't know anything about, is, you know, once you invent radio, how long do you stick around broadcasting before something terrible happens, or just something that's not so terrible, you just go extinct, right? We don't know that either.
So what are your idea or thoughts on the fact that we are looking for water to look for life? Do you think that we always have to look for water to look for life? I mean, there have been extremophiles and, you know, organisms even on Earth that survive even without water, or they don't need the essentials we think that are needed for life. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, on Earth, actually, all life does need water. There are things that can go into spore form for long periods of time, maybe even millions of years, and they just sit there doing nothing, maybe having bad dreams, who knows. But, you know, microscopic goodies, you know, in spore form can survive. But to do anything, you know, very lively, you need water. Now, that's on Earth. The thing is that without a liquid, you don't have very much chemistry going on. So that's really why we look for water. Water is a good liquid because it's liquid over a wide range of temperatures. There's a lot of water in the universe and so forth. But it may not be the only liquid that works. On Saturn's moon Titan, of course, they're big lakes, you know, same as, I mean, they're as big as Lake Superior, right? But they're filled with liquid natural gas. It's not water, but there could be some life in there. I mean, it's not impossible.
Let me switch gears to, you do a lot of outreach stuff as well. Mm-hmm. So when you meet, let's say, young people, and you meet adults or older age people, what kind of different ideas?
No young people are adults.
I mean kids. So what kind of different ideas do they have? Like, do you meet people who think that aliens don't exist?
There are some people who don't believe that aliens exist, but they're mostly older people, actually. I always ask audiences, if I'm giving a talk, how many of you think E.T. is really out there? And if it's, college kids or kids in elementary school or young adults, essentially every hand goes up. They've seen a lot of movies, so they're convinced the aliens are out there. If you ask retired people, then maybe a third of them will say maybe not. And if I ask them, but why is it that you don't think they're out there? It's never very clear. I think they're just a little more conservative about their views of such things.
Okay, so you just mentioned people. There have been a lot of movies and shows talking about, you know, aliens. So how do you think these kinds of things affect the minds of the younger people who think that aliens exist?
Well, there are various consequences of seeing a lot of alien movies, and I have seen a lot of alien movies. In fact, last night I just saw Prometheus, another alien movie. So I like them myself. I always like the aliens because they're really kind of nasty, and you have to sort of get into that. Well, there are two effects. One is, of course, that a lot of people think that because they've seen so many aliens in the movies that the aliens are everywhere. One-third of the population of Canada, not to mention one-third of the population of the United States, believes that the aliens are actually visiting the Earth, right? Flying around in their flying saucers occasionally, you know, hauling people out of their homes. I don't think that's true, by the way, but a lot of people do. So that's one consequence, that they feel very comfortable with aliens because they've just seen them all over the place, right? But the other thing, and I think this is actually a much more important consequence, is that kids who go to these movies get hooked on science, some of them, maybe only one in 50. That happened to me. That happens to a lot of people. If you go around and ask scientists, how did you get interested in science? You'd be surprised how many of them say, well, I went to see these really bad movies when I was a kid. And it isn't that the movies have very good science in them. They generally don't. The science is usually kind of nutty. But the emotional appeal of the films is what draws them in. It's like, you know, how many people are trying to study forensic science today thanks to television shows like CSI, right? Because it makes it romantic.
In terms of outreach as well, you also write a lot of books. How did that come to your mind, writing books for, you know, university kids or normal people reading it?
Yeah, well, normal people do not include university kids. I agree with you there. But I do a lot of writing, but mostly I write articles, actually, because you can write an article and you get a lot more readers than you do if you write a book, usually, and it's a lot faster. But I have written, what, 4 books or something. And, you know, it's just something I happen to like to do. Even as a kid, I liked writing. And so I still enjoy that just as an activity. I like writing. When I write an article, whatever it is, and I like what I've written, which happens maybe one time in 10, I don't know. But then I sleep better at night. I just, there's something satisfying in it, right? It's like anything else you do that you've done well, you like it. So it's just an interest in writing. But it's also the case that by writing, you can tell people about things that are happening that you think are interesting and that they might find interesting. It's just another means of communication. You can give talks, and you give a talk, and you may reach a couple of hundred people, maybe a couple thousand people at best. But if you write an article or even a book, you'll reach many, many more. And it's there forever too. The talk is kind of ephemeral.
So how important do you think outreach is in terms of reaching to masses for educating them in sciences and getting this whole science culture coming in? Because I know that there are many people who drop out of schools and just because they think it's very hard to study science or it's not that interesting. So why do you think that outreach can really help, you know, advertising science, I would say?
Well, it's hard to say whether it actually does help. You know, how can you measure that? If you look at science literacy, for example, today, and you compare it with the way it was 50 years ago, is it really any better today than it was then? I mean, it's probably been bad forever. I mean, who knows? I sort of had the feeling that it's been bad forever. But on the other hand, you know, it's one of those things, it's sort of like, you know, being kind to people. You don't really know whether that's improved the world, but you just have the feeling that it's a lot better than the alternative. And that's the way I feel about outreach. Because I remember when I was a kid, somebody would come to our school or I would go to a talk at a museum or just go to the planetarium, whatever it was. It didn't have to be a talk about astronomy or anything that I eventually did. It was just a talk. And I would find these, you know, kind of interesting, motivating, and I would go to the library and pick out a book on the subject or whatever, right? So it worked with me, and so I had the feeling that it must work for other people too, because I don't figure I'm that special. Copernicus told me that I'm probably not special.
So you actually did study astrobiology in your master's or PhD, or your field was completely different, you actually got diverted into this one?
Yeah, I don't know that astrobiology was much of a field when I got my PhD. That was I think that was just before Captain Cook mapped Newfoundland. I'm not sure what it was. It was a while ago. But in any case, I studied astronomy. I studied physics and astronomy, and in fact, radio astronomy. I was measuring the speeds of rotations of galaxies, and they all rotated too fast, which turned out to be a rather important result. But in any case, so yeah, no, I wasn't studying astrobiology. There weren't many people doing astrobiology when I was a student. But the radio astronomy taught me the techniques that are used in SETI. So that's how I got into SETI. And when you work at the SETI Institute, 9 out of 10 people you see in the halls, 19 out of 20 people you see in the halls are astrobiologists, not SETI people. So, you know, you picked some of it up just by talking to these people.
Okay, so let me ask you this way. Being an astronomer is different, I would say, in terms of normal people's idea. How hard or easy has it been in terms of letting people know that you are an astronomer? It's a kind of field that's a budding field and people should take interest in these kind of fields.
Well, I don't think it's terribly hard to convince people that astronomy is interesting. I mean, surveys, at least in the United States, have shown that, you know, of the sciences, the two that appeal to the largest fraction of people are biology. We're all interested in life, after all, right? And, you know, furry animals or human biology, well, whatever, right? Biology is a winner. And the other winner is, it turns out, not organic chemistry, you know, not high energy physics, not, you know, non-Euclidean geometry. It's astronomy. And that's kind of interesting because astronomy doesn't have too many practical applications anymore. I mean, it used to. It was good for navigation. But, you know, it's just something that satisfies our interest in knowing how the universe came to be, why we're here, where we fit in, those sorts of questions. And most people have some interest in that. There are very few people I meet who have absolutely no interest in astronomy. It's a funny thing. It's rather gratifying, actually. So if I tell people I'm an astronomer, they don't, you know, at a party or something, it's very infrequent that they'll say, well, excuse me, I have to go refresh my drink now.
So do you think Apollo missions are to thank for those kind of, you know, why people like astronomy or think about astronomy?
Well, certainly the expeditions to the moon helped. And I mean, of course, that's more space research than astronomy, if you will. But, you know, there's some astronomy involved, obviously. The moon is an astronomical body. That helped. But I think that it probably worked the other way. I mean, the real reason we went to the moon, of course, it was more political reasons. But, you know, the people were interested in astronomy. And then when, after the Second World War, when it turned out you could build rockets that actually could go somewhere. And people said, you know, you could use these things to go to the moon or beyond. You know, people were already interested. So I think it was the interest in astronomy that motivated a bit of the moon race as well.
So what can we expect more from SETI in next coming decade or two?
Well, I think that SETI will continue to speed up the search. And that's a consequence of the improvements in technology. We keep building better instruments that allow us to search the sky for signals much more quickly than we could do in the past. I mean, compared to the experiments that were done 20 years ago, you know, in one day you do as much as they could do in a year. So the search is speeding up, and that makes me optimistic that in the course of the next maybe two or three decades, we're, you know, it's not unreasonable to assume that we'll find a signal. Unless, of course, the aliens are not out there, and we are, as my brother likes to think, the smartest things in the universe.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to my interview with Dr. Sechostek, and he was talking about SETI, which is fascination for normal people. You know, we are looking for life. So what are your thoughts about, you know, looking for life in universe?
I think it's fascinating for scientists as well, right? We all want to think that we can achieve this goal of finding life, and SETI is definitely doing a different tack on that project than looking at planetary atmospheres or whatever, and presents our best chance at actually finding intelligent life. So it's really nice to know that someone's giving that a go.
It's really interesting, and I always enjoyed this about the Drake equation, which was something that came out of a conference that preceded the founding of SETI. And there are many different terms in the Drake equation, but at the very end, what we were trying to figure out is how much intelligent life there is in the universe. And they have a definition of what intelligent life is. Intelligent life is able to build radio telescopes, which is exactly what we're looking for with SETI.
It's kind of self-flattering for these people who do radio astronomy.
Well, it's intelligent life we can find.
Yeah, of course. Exactly. Of course,
yeah. If it's not detectable, if it's not testable, it's not science.
Yeah, well, and there's also, you know, maybe there is intelligent life out there that is making pots and carving spears or whatever, but there's no way of noticing that from very far away, so you have to define it this way.
And a bit more concerning in some respects is the fact that we were very radio loud starting in the 1950s, and even a little bit before that with regular radio and then television and so forth.
Yeah.
But in the last few years, the Earth has become much more radio quiet.
Yeah, well, for example, this program comes out over the internet now. We're not broadcasting this over airwaves as much as we used to do with programs. And if we send everything through cables, then only people who are plugged in can hear it.
Exactly. And so if you were an observer at another star, you see this, we have this expanding sphere of radio waves that defines the space in which people would be aware of our existence. Or I would say, I shouldn't say people, but
there are people.
Things.
Aliens.
Little green men.
Whatever's out there, where one could detect the human race. And so that, we always thought of it as a sphere that continues to expand. It seems now like it's more of sort of a surface in which you have a sort of another sphere of silence inside of it.
One blast of 50 years or so of radio.
That's right. It goes by once, and maybe that's why that wow signal, you know, we only heard it once. We've never heard anything again from that direction. That was their burst of television programming, and we're never going to get it again.
He also talked about how people do actually think that we are visited by, you know, aliens, especially talking about Roswell and Area 51. I think people have this fascination about, and like, I think they feel good when they think about, you know, having someone like us around in the universe, since it's huge. It's not like a tiny space as we thought before. It had many stars, and now we know it has many planets as well. All these stars in the universe, and we are looking for Earth-sized planets and probably water somewhere on those planets, and have an idea of probably having some kind of life, if not intelligent life, maybe stupid life, as he coins it.
Well, it's a big universe, and I think most people would tend to say there's got to be other life out there. If life happened here, then it's got to happen elsewhere, because we're not special, as he repeated.
What is that line from Carl Sagan's Cosmos, who's also a big player in this sort of game, or was? Something, it'd be a shame, all that wasted space.
All that, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of universe out there. There's a whole lot of stars. There's a whole lot of galaxies. You know, they take the Hubble Deep Field. You stare at a tiny sub-degree fraction of the sky, and you see 10,000 galaxies.
But well, just the Kepler region of what that satellite is looking at is 100,000 stars or something, and that's a very, very small region, smaller than the constellation Cygnus.
Yeah.
And it's just full of tons and tons of planets. And
but they're also very far away.
They're very far away.
Yeah.
Would the radio signals reach us from all that far away?
Yeah, well, the star looks like a point, right? And to be able to detect a planet, you need a very sensitive instrument like Kepler that can detect very small changes in the brightness of a star. Now, any radio signal is going to be a lot fainter than the star. So it'll be hard to detect things from those distances. And certainly it would be hard to fly there and pull somebody out of a pickup truck.
But it's amazing what we can do and what the capabilities are. So for instance, you take an instrument like the Very Large Array, the VLA in New Mexico, which was built in part to help with the Deep Space Network's capabilities, because we realized after Voyager was out there and it was doing well, that past Saturn, we didn't have a good way of communicating with it and picking up the signal. Now, Voyager isn't broadcasting at, 5 million watts. It's not a radio station, in a major city. It's actually quite a quiet signal to pick up. And we can do that at the distance that it's at.
Yeah, Saturn is a lot closer than some of these exoplanets, though.
It is, but presumably, you'd hope that they'd broadcast with a little more power.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can bring that up by as many orders of magnitude as it takes to overcome the distance, but it's, there's going to be a distance problem, and there's also the time problem, right? You have to hope that there are civilizations that are living contemporaneously with us, or the right amount of time ago that the light speed and distance equation works out that we can hear them now.
Well, let's be optimistic and hope that intelligent civilizations last fairly long.
Yeah, that would be nice.
And that is one of those key undefines from the Drake equation. I mean, imagine that we actually get the signal, we find a place that, and there's debate about this on Earth, whether we should broadcast our existence out there. You get the signal, and then from a solar system that's a long ways away, many light years, and so you start an expedition there, and on the way, you run into the back end of the transmissions, and then by the time you get there, there's nothing left. Now, of course, not everyone believes that there is a ton of life out there. We've got the problem that we only know of one real example, our own solar system. And so it's very difficult to figure out what factors make us special, what factors led to life emerging here. And so by getting more of a census with things like Kepler, we'll find out. But there is a hypothesis out there called the rare earth hypothesis from the late 90s at the University of Washington, which posits that basically, single-celled life, bacteria, stuff on that level, is probably common, because we see life showing up on the Earth very quickly, but that things like us might be more rare.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, it's hard to estimate what the values of these various factors in that equation are going to have. The other thing, of course, is the detection problem. The radio signal could be passing right through here right now, and we're just not tuned into the right frequency or recognizing it as a modulated signal.
Which is good that we have SETI. At least someone is trying.
They're trying, yeah. But it's a very large search space to work with.
Well, which is why they do a lot of crowdsourcing. You can download, basically it's a screensaver.
SETI at home.
Yeah. When you're not using your computer, it processes through the
spare cycles, yeah. But of course, you that's all data that has been received, right? There's a lot of potential, there's a lot of frequency and time and direction space that will never be searched because we can't search everything. And so it's easy to miss these things. On the other hand, even if you sent a spacecraft to some nearby planet, in the solar system perhaps, to look for life, even that kind of light is hard to detect unambiguously. And so whether you have it right in front of you or whether it's sending you signals from light years away, you might trip over it and not notice it. It's hard.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Parshdi Patel and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Parshdi Patel. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Dave Kirsch, Raymond Francis, Parshdi Patel, and John Moores. Our editors were Parshdi Patel, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.